This conference is being recorded. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the June NJ EDA Telephonic Board Meeting. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised today's meeting is being recorded. When the chairman opens the public comment portion of the meeting, members of the public will be advised to press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad to be placed into a queue to speak and provide comment. You will be asked to provide your name and any organization with which you are affiliated. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the number. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star and then 0. I would now like to turn the conference over to Chairman Kevin Quinn. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Operator. Tim, if you could begin by reading the Open Public Meeting Notice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. In accordance with the Open Public Meeting Act, notice of this meeting has been sent to the Star Ledger and the Times of Trenton at least 48 hours prior to this meeting, and a meeting notice has been posted on the Secretary of State's bulletin board at the Department of State. Pursuant to the Internal Revenue Code of 1986, as amended, this is a public hearing and comments are invited on any private activity bonds presented today. Back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you, Tim. Manera, if we could do a roll call.
Yes, sir. Chairman Kevin Quinn.
Here.
Vice Chairman Charles Farlow.
Here.
Ryan Wilson from the Governor's Office.
Here.
Banking Commissioner Caridi.
Present.
Labor Commissioner Angelo.
Here.
For State Treasurer Moyo.
Here.
Elizabeth Dragon for DEP Commissioner Lotteray.
Here.
Phil Elagia.
Present.
Virginia Bauer.
Here.
Fred Dumont.
Good morning. I'm here.
Rosemary Hicks.
Present.
Marcia Marley.
Here.
And Robert Shimko. Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Robert Shimko here.
Great. Thank you, Manera.
You're welcome.
All right. The first, you got it. First item on our agenda is approval of last month's meeting minutes. That's the May 12, 2021 meeting minutes. Folks know the routine here. Please state your name for the record when making a motion or seconding. Can I get a motion to approve the May 12th meeting minutes?
So moved. Wilson.
Marlene, 3 seconds.
Thank you, Marlene. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. I have some brief comments for this morning. The COVID-19 situation and prospects for New Jersey's recovery continue to improve. There's still a massive need for support as businesses recover from the pandemic. The EDA is working hard to address these needs. We've reopened the pre-registration phase 4, the Small Business Emergency Assistance Grant Program, for businesses that missed the April window. We are working towards standing up a grant program for arts and cultural institutions. We expect to soon receive additional funding for Sustain and Serve New Jersey. We continue to make progress rolling out programs created under the Economic Recovery Act of 2020. Applications have launched for Emerge and the reopened Residential Economic Redevelopment and Growth, or ERG, programs. Today, the board will consider program rules for the updated offshore wind tax credit program, and multiple other programs are currently going through the rulemaking process and will launch in the coming months. The EDA is supporting communities and businesses as they adjust to the new realities of a post-COVID workplace. Sustain and Serve New Jersey continues to provide funds to help restaurants recover from the impact of the pandemic. The PPE Access Program provides 10% discounts on PPE purchases from EDA-approved designated vendors. We are currently accepting applications for the 21st Century Redevelopment Program, which will help municipalities plan new uses for vacant or underutilized office parks, malls, and other stranded assets. Tim, let me turn it over to you for the CEO report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief so we can get to the agenda. First, I want to echo everything that the chairman just said. There's a lot going on and a lot of really good stuff going on. I think on balance for the first time in a while, kind of May into June is when the good news on the pandemic, the good news on the economic front, the good news on so many front, the vaccine front has been dramatically outstripping the challenges. And that means that we continue to be busy. We continue to be incredibly busy. The phase four of the grant program for COVID is up and running and making approvals. As of this morning, slightly more than 5,000 businesses have received more than $60 million. That number changes, by the every 5 or 10 minutes as Bruce and the team that are overseeing the approvals process continue to keep that machine running, even during this board meeting, I'm sure. But we appreciate that. The Senate on Thursday of last week passed, I think it was unanimously, all five bills, a package of bills now heading to the governor's desk to support an additional $235 million, $200 million of which goes to fund phase four. 10 of which goes to support Sustain and Serve, and 25 for a new program that we'll be coming back to you with a proposal for probably over the summer to support businesses that have opened or expanded during the pandemic, which is a sort of a companion program to what Derek will be talking about in a few minutes with the second phase of our loan program. So there's a ton of things going on. The good news is with the agreement that the governor and the Senate president and the speaker announced for that $235 million, we will not have to decline anyone who's eligible in phase four for lack of funds. There will be declines because the folks might not be eligible for the grant for whatever reason, but it won't be for lack of funding. And so that's something that will continue to keep us quite busy through the summer, and that's needed, as the chairman just said. I just want to pause as we talk about the grants and all the COVID programs. Obviously the clouds have continued to part, and the end of the public health emergency and the sort of the return to, for most of us, some degree of normalcy in our lives is great news. But we'll continue to run these programs, at least through the summer and into the early fall, and then begin to work on other things that will continue to crop up to support the recovery as we kind of get out of the pandemic itself. We got some really good news, a very positive report card that I think I shared with each member of the board on an audit that was conducted by the state auditor through OLS of our COVID programs, focusing primarily on the grant and loan programs, but they did review some of the other companion programs as well. And it's a report card that I know I'm incredibly proud of, and I know our team is incredibly proud of, and I hope the board is as well. When you have an audit, first of all, we always welcome outside advice and perspectives and checking on us to make sure we're doing the right things. It's an obligation. It's part of our obligations as stewards of taxpayer resources to be welcoming and supportive of that kind of those inquiries, whether it's on grants or tax credits or anything else. But when you have an audit, you want a sort of a short and sweet report that includes phrases like, had appropriate controls in place to oversee the program. So that's exactly what we got in this grant program. So I'm enormously grateful to the work and dedication and the quality and the integrity of the work done by our team on these grant programs, which were stood up in some senses, it feels like 5 minutes ago. In some senses, it feels like a decade ago last March when we stood up the first phase of the grant program before there was a CARES Act, before there was a federal response. We had Governor Murphy had announced programs to be up and running. And so I'm incredibly proud of the quality of the work that was pulled off in extraordinary, that was accomplished in extraordinary circumstances when we all had chaos in our personal lives, private lives, and work lives, and we're all dealing with the onset of the pandemic on through to now. So I just want to say thanks to the team and to the board for their support, and of course the governor and the leadership of the both chambers of the legislature for their support for the funding for these programs, because it's made a huge difference in the lives of 65,000 businesses and growing as we continue to make awards. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll hand the floor back to you. We got a good agenda to get through, and I will yield the floor back to you.
Great. Thank you, Tim. Let's move to the first item on the agenda, Small Business Emergency Assistance Loan Program Phase 2, a program modification. Derek Benz, Director, Business Banking and Bonds. Derek.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and board members. Today, I will be discussing a request to modify Phase 2 of the Small Business Emergency Assistance Loan Program. The program was initially approved at the July 2020 board meeting and is funded by a $10 million U.S. EDA RLF. We will be requesting delegation to the Chief Executive Officer to execute a modified agreement on terms consistent with the application and specific awards conditions for the $11 million U.S. EDA RLF. Also, we'll be requesting modification to the Small Business Emergency Assistance Loan Program, Phase 2, as summarized below and outlined in Exhibit A, as well as delegations to staff for approvals, declinations, appeals, and portfolio services to support the efficient processes created through the program as summarized and outlined below. At the March 2020 board meeting, the members approved Phase 1 of the Small Business Emergency Assistance Loan Program that was funded by EDA balance sheet dollars and had a $10 million program size. Phase 1 launched in April of 2020, and over 3,500 applications were received for a total request of approximately $248 million. There were 145 approvals in Phase 1 for $10.2 million. Both Phase 1 and the previously approved Phase 2 were open to all eligible businesses and 501c not-for-profits. With the abundance of funding available at the state and federal level for businesses in existence prior to the pandemic, the launch of Phase 2 was delayed. The purpose of the delay was to create a loan program that was different than the current offerings in the marketplace. The proposed request for the modification to Phase 2 of the Small Business Emergency Assistance Loan Program will allow us to accomplish that. Phase 2 will now be targeted to eligible applicants that have leased new space, leased additional space, or acquired a building on or after January 1, 2021. That is a minimum of 500 square feet. If leased additional space, the incremental increase in additional space must be a minimum of 500 square feet, not the aggregate of the applicant's total leased space. This targeted group will now be considered Stage 1 applicants. We will be implementing some process improvements from lessons learned in Phase 1 to allow the application process to work better for applicants, as well as allow staff to manage the heavy volume of applications in a timely manner, as it took approximately 12 months to review, approve, and deploy the capital in Phase 1. Applicants will now be required to pre-register, which will be their ticket to apply when the application launches. If they do not pre-register, they will not be eligible to apply when the application goes live. Supporting documentation will be requested post-application, as there were numerous document deficiencies in Phase 1 when documents were required to be uploaded at the time of application. Lastly, we will be instituting credit scoring for business applicants, recognizing that utilizing a guarantor's credit score does not determine a business's ability to repay debt. But if the applicant was able to successfully maintain their personal credit during the pandemic, it is a good indicator that they can sufficiently manage their business finances as well. There will still be a $3.5 million set aside for applicants located in eligible opportunity zones. The applicant must be in existence by the date of application launch, so we could be lending to a mature company that's been around for 10 years or more, or it could be a business that started operating during the pandemic. Revenue size will increase from $5 million or less to $10 million or less. Applicants will no longer need to certify negative COVID impacts, as all have been impacted by the pandemic at this time. Applicants will still need to be in good standing with taxation and Department of Labor, as well as comply with duplication of benefits requirements. Eligible uses remain the same: inventory, rent, mortgage, payroll, utilities, PPE, and FF&E. We anticipate that the application would be open for a period of 1 to 3 weeks, depending upon application volume and availability of funding. We will allow Stage 1 applicants a 10-day window to apply, and if for some reason we do not receive sufficient applications to get us through the $10 million allocation, we would allow applicants to apply that meet the other eligible criteria. This group of applicants will be considered Stage 2 applicants. As previously mentioned, we will be credit scoring the businesses based on the majority owner's middle credit score. But not-for-profits will be required a full underwriting as they would need to meet the minimum 1.0 debt service coverage requirement. There will be three loan tiers for businesses, and not-for-profits would be eligible for up to $100,000. Credit scores from 600 to 700 would be eligible for up to $50,000. Credit scores 701 to 749 would be eligible for up to $75,000. And credit scores 750 to 850 would be eligible for up to $100,000. Regardless of the eligible amount for the credit score and loans here, the loan will be sized based on eligible expenses. We will use the three-month average for variable expenses, looking out a maximum of 18 months. Invoices will be required for FF&E, which would be a one-time expense. The term will remain at 10 years. The interest rate will change from 0% for the first 5 years and the prevailing floor rate for the balance of the 5 years to 0% for the entire loan term. Payment deferral will be extended from 12 months to 24 months. We will still be filing a blanket lien on business assets as well as requiring a personal guarantee from all owners. Staff has had several conversations with the U.S. EDA, and they are fully aware of the proposed modification to the program, and they are supportive of the changes. The next steps with them would be to submit a request to modify our existing RLF plan after board approval. Based on the proposed modifications, the changes are minimal. Again, we are recommending approval for delegation to the CEO to execute any modification agreements. Modification to the Small Business Assistance Emergency Assistance Loan Program, as well as delegations to staff for approvals, declinations, appeals, and management of the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Derek. Do we have any questions for Derek?
Hi, Derek.
All right.
Marie.
Go ahead, Rosemary.
A quick question on the credit score. I know you said that one of the criteria is that if they were able to maintain a credit score, I guess, at 600 or above, they're considered a better credit risk. And maybe those are that's my framing and not yours. But I guess my question is if someone has gone through a year of reduced business, and let's say they were a 600, 650 credit score, and because of the business, while it didn't, it dropped to, let's say, to 590 or 580. I'm not really sure how those numbers are derived. I just think that is a window. And is it possible, or was there consideration that if they were less than 600, we could do a further look back to see if they had a better credit score pre-pandemic as one of the qualifiers or decisions that are being made? I just think that, you know, if the purpose is to get businesses, micro businesses, that the reason that we brought the credit score down was to provide some assistance, and I'm thinking if they were on the margin or right at that 600 or 620 and it falls below as a result of a one-year problem, is there the possibility for a look back further to see if they had a better credit score pre-pandemic than they do post? That was a long question. Sorry.
That's okay. Good morning. So we are solely using, I mean, outside of making sure that they're within good standing with the sister agencies, but we would not be underwriting based on cash flow. So we are solely looking at primarily just the credit score to make the determination for approval outside of sizing the loan based on the historical uses. So with that in mind, it had, you know, we're looking at a lower tier if the credit score is lower, but we had not envisioned going lower than 600 for a credit score for approval, since we would not be doing a full underwriting. Now, if they are other owners that may have a better credit score, we can still look to approve them, and they, but they would, wouldn't be able to get approved for any more than the $50,000. So we looked at trying to be as flexible as possible, but felt as though going below 600 for a credit score only loan program wouldn't be in the best interest of the funding.
And Derek, if I could just add to that, Tim. Hey, morning, Rosemary. I believe, and Laurie or Derek, correct me if I'm wrong, because this is a matter of my, if I have any areas of expertise, this certainly isn't one of them. USDDA says basically you have to use whatever underwriting criteria you've used in other programs, and if we have never gone below 600 before, so we would be violating that rule if we did that here. I don't disagree with your point at all, Rosemary, but I think the USDDA says basically you've got to use your kind of house rules historically with federal money. Is that a fair characterization, Derek and or Laurie?
Yeah.
Was that a fair question? I'm sorry, I was putting in my other earbud. Was that a fair recap that Tim made for Laurie? I didn't know if Laurie and the other person chimed in.
I'm sorry, it's Laurie. I was on mute. Yeah, so the USDDA would ask that we frame out very clear criteria and then have to be able to follow that criteria when doing the analysis. And so this is the first time we're doing a credit score type of program. And so, and the average that Derek described is a way to try to manage the variances that may exist in the credit score process.
That seems a little different than what Tim said, but I'll let it go.
I agree that is different than what I said, I might have had that wrong. So.
Yeah, so, I think, sorry, this is Brian Sabina. Maybe just to clarify, I agree with Rosemary, that was a bit confusing. We have, what Laurie said is we've never underwritten a loan driven on a credit score, although we have these credit scores as an eligibility criteria for loans in the past, I believe. So what Tim is saying is that, you know, the thresholds we've used in the past have been down to 600, and maintaining consistency with those thresholds is what we're saying in this. As Laurie mentioned, creating a clear process that aligns kind of underwriting standards and making sure that that's clear to all parties, including the U.S. federal government, and that we are kind of treating their money like our money is part of our agreement that we signed with the USDDA.
Yeah, I wasn't entirely making it up. Okay, thank you, Ryan.
All right, one last point, and then I will let it go, but I guess if we are sort of treading a new territory and stating that we're going to treat their money like our money, like their money, however Brian portrays that. If we draw the line at the 600, then we are then setting, although one incident doesn't make a precedent, but we are sort of saying that this is going to be the threshold. And again, coming off of a pandemic, it's just a consideration. And I'll just let it go at that.
Yeah, the other thing, I'd add to this, Rosemary, I take your point to heart. We have coming as sort of a companion program to this is going to be a grant program. This is part of this. It's not signed into law yet, so I'm sort of I'm speculating, but the bill is passed. The legislature has not yet been signed, but that would allocate $25 million of funding, of grant funding, to be sort of a companion to this lending program. Smaller dollars than $100,000, but than the up to $100,000, but for the same sort of set of businesses that are either opened or expanded or taken on new space. We'll probably use exactly the same criteria, which will be just a grant, which I'm positive/hopeful will reach deeper and get at the folks that you're describing, because I don't disagree. This will not get to everybody. It's also only $10 million, which is a lot of money, but not as much money as we need.
Right. We're going to touch more people with something like this, and I just, again, just like to remind us that we need to ensure that when we're standing up these programs, that the logic and narrative behind it is the same as if it was some of the larger organizations where we possibly make some allowances. But I'll leave it at that, and thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Derek? Okay. If we have no questions for Derek, can I get a motion to approve?
Jenny Bauer, I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Can I get a second?
Kathy Brennan, second.
Thank you, Kathy. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. Let's move to the policy section. I'd like to report as chair of the policy committee the next several agenda items. Of note for communities, today's staff will present a request for approval of the creation of the Government Restricted Municipality Planning Grants Program, utilizing funding from the New Jersey Economic Recovery Act of 2020 to make grant funding available to three communities to maximize their growth potential and help facilitate the implementation of economic growth projects locally. I look forward to seeing the fruits of this work to come in the future. And we'll begin with a request for release of U.S. EDA federal interest in revolving loan funds. Lori Mathias, SVP, Finance and Development, presenting. Lori.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Chairman. The memo before you is requesting the board's approval to allow the authority to submit a request to the U.S. EDA to release its federal interest in revolving loan funds. By way of background, the authority has been administering U.S. EDA revolving loan fund awards for over 40 years. The authority received its first revolving loan fund grant award of $13 million from U.S. EDA in 1976 and has since been managing five revolving loan funds totaling over $20 million. These RLF awards were deployed in loans and have revolved within our lending programs over the years. In total, the RLF funds have supported nearly 850 loans for over $200 million. In March of this year, U.S. EDA extended invitations to RLF recipients to request the release of the U.S. EDA federal interest in the revolving loan funds that have operated satisfactorily for 7 years beyond the initial disbursement of the grant funds. The RLFs outlined in your attachment meet that requirement and are eligible to be included in a request for release. The opportunity to have the federal interest in these RLFs released is attractive because it will reduce the administrative burden on New Jersey EDA relating to reporting, and it will allow flexibility in the use of funds. The RLF funds will continue to be used for economic development lending and other programs that foster economic development activities. I want to note that NJEDA will work with New Jersey Department of State to facilitate the defederalization of one of the grants on the list, which is part of this board memo. It's award number 01-1963-008, and it was initially granted in 1995 to New Jersey Department of Commerce and Economic Development, with New Jersey Economic Development identified as a subgrantee. Since the time of that initial award, the Department of Commerce and Economic Development has gone through a series of organizational and structural changes by statute and executive order, which ultimately places the grant under the Department of State today. The EDA has been administering this award along with the other RLF awards directly. The funds related to all of these awards are currently included in the reports that we have been regularly submitting to USEDA, and it will be included in the final report as part of the release request. The board memo will be revised slightly to include additional detail outlining the transition of the Department of Commerce, and note that we will work with the Department of State to facilitate the request and ultimate release. In conclusion, we are recommending the board members approve the submission of a written request and required documentation to USEDA to release its federal interest in the five RLFs and to provide delegated authority to the CEO to execute the agreement and any other documentation necessary to memorialize the release. Thank you for your consideration.
Great. Do we have any questions for Lori? All right. If there's no questions for Lori, can I get a motion to approve? Motion to approve, please.
Elizabeth Dragon, motion to approve.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Can I get a second? Who is that?
Marcia.
Marcia.
Go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Marcia. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. Next item on our agenda, the use of the Economic Relief Act of 2020, appropriation and creation of the government-restricted municipality planning grants. John Costello, Program Manager, Policy and Data Analytics. John.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen of the board, thank you for taking the time today. I'd like to present for your consideration the creation of the government-restricted municipality planning grants. This is a two-phase, $3 million series of competitive economic development grants to government-restricted municipalities, which are defined by statute as Atlantic City, Patterson, and Trenton. This program is competitive in selection and focused in impact. The first phase of the program is a $750,000 funding for the government-restricted municipalities, Atlantic City, Patterson, and Trenton, for strategic action plans. These strategic action plans will analyze the library of municipal and stakeholder economic development plans, identify projects that promote the goals of the strategic action plan, and determine the gaps in technical planning that hold back these projects. This is open to multiple government, philanthropic, and higher education entities as authors for the exclusive benefit of the government-restricted municipalities. Each one of these applicants must have the authority to bid on the funds on behalf of the government-restricted municipality. Phase two is $2.25 million in funding for the projects identified in phase one. This will fund those identified technical planning gaps found in the project plans and will be open only to the municipalities themselves. The grant awards will be graded by a multidisciplinary EDA committee and awarded by the board. For phase one, we asked the board for the creation of the government-restricted municipality planning grant program to make grant funding available that will maximize New Jersey municipality growth potential by providing custom blueprints for a long-term strategic action plan, as well as authorizing $750,000 in funding from the allocation as listed in the Economic Recovery Act of 2020. Some background on this. This program seeks to assist communities in leveraging planning capacity to meet community goals. The program, at its core, is a design and submission of detailed, long-term, and action-oriented strategic plans that incorporates the existing plans from the government-restricted municipalities and identifies the technical capacity needs that have held back these projects from completion. This grant program will better position the government-restricted municipalities to implement and execute on these stalled projects. The program is open to the cities themselves of Trenton, Atlantic City, and Patterson. Any other New Jersey municipality, New Jersey counties, and authorities, accredited higher education institutions, public interest research groups, and professional service providers may submit themselves as plan applicants and authors. Each plan applicant must have completed at least one municipal county or New Jersey state government plan focused on economic revitalization. These plans are for the sole benefit of the government-restricted municipalities. The prospective applicants must have a letter of support from the chief executive, the mayor, of the government-restricted municipality where they plan to focus their work. We see this as empowering the cities themselves. They have the option to either do it themselves or work with partners to complete the plan. The applications will be accepted for up to 60 days after the application opening, and then will be reviewed and scored by a multidisciplinary EDA committee made up of staff. Proposals with scores equal to or greater than 50 will be presented to the board for review and award. The committee will then make recommendations to the board of the highest ranked application for each government restricted municipality. The board will vote on the grant award, and we expect the awards to be made, the money to go out the door, in fourth quarter of 2021. The length of the program is 6 months, with one extension of 1 month at the authority's discretion. The scope of work, again, is to develop long-term strategic action plans. This will comprise an in-depth analysis of community plans from both the municipality and major stakeholders. They will identify projects in these plans and the technical planning gaps that restrict these projects from moving forward. These planning gaps can be in multiple areas around, such as the need for business analysis, the need for project financing analysis, the need to go into significant community engagement planning, as well as architectural, environmental, marketing, and other detailed technical analyses. The eligible respondents who can apply for this, the cities themselves, Trenton, Atlantic City, Patterson, any other New Jersey municipality, county, or authority, accredited higher education institutions, public interest research groups, and professional service providers. Again, these would be eligible to be the authors of the plans working in conjunction with the municipalities. They must have experience having completed at least one municipal, county, or New Jersey state plan. And again, this leaves a range of choices for the government-restricted municipality to choose the author of their strategic action plan. These plans must articulate how the plans will position the municipality to activate projects as part of an overall economic development strategy, how the plans will enhance local capacity. They must show viable plans to implementation and show collaborative stakeholder engagement process. Additionally, and they need to identify those specific challenges, difficulties, and issues that have the potential to impede project investment and explain and identify a solution in that gap. As for the applicants themselves, applicants may submit multiple individual applications focused but each must be focused on one individual GRM. Applicants must provide a letter of support from the chief executive of one of the government-restricting municipalities, Atlantic City, Patterson, or Trenton. The municipality itself may propose to author a plan, or the municipality may choose to issue letters of support to multiple applicants in order for the plan. There's an expected 60-day application window for the length of time. This is an aggressive timeline, but we see it as an opportunity to work with both Governor Murphy's new package as well as the ARP funding flowing from Washington, D.C. We expect to present, again, these to the board in the fourth quarter. And, again, they'll be evaluated on the ability to achieve the planning goals outlined in the scope of work, the ability to analyze multiple plans and find those actionable items for projects, a defined collaborative investment and stakeholder engagement strategy, support from the government-restricted municipality in the form of a letter from the chief executive, as well as detailed information on their experience in executing these type of plans. The disbursement schedule will be 50% at the execution of the grant agreement, or this will be $125,000, 25% at the halfway point of the term, and 25% at the completion and submission of the plan. The progress reports will be required at each step of the way to detail funds expended to date and the milestones achieved before any funds are disbursed from the authority. So to reiterate again, the request is made to the board for the creation of the Government Restricted Municipality Planning Grant Program and the authorization of $750,000 in funding for the Economic Recovery Act. As phase one. Mr. Chair, should I move on to phase two or should I wait here?
No, we need to have a vote on the, and Danielle, please correct me if I'm wrong. I think we need to see if there's any questions on this section and then have a vote before moving to the next.
Yeah, we should do the two matters separately.
Okay. Thank you.
All righty. On the first part that John just covered, do we have any questions for John? All right. If there's no questions for John, can I get a motion to approve?
Elizabeth Dragon, motion to approve.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Can I get a second?
Kathy, second.
Thank you, Kathy. Any discussion? There's no discussion. All in favor, aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, John, please continue with the second item, the government restricted municipality planning grant implementation funding, phase two. John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, phase two, we asked for the creation of phase two of the government restricted municipality planning grant to make grant funding available for the technical planning as described in the long-term strategic action plans completed in phase one, authorized $2,250,000 in funding from the planning grant allocation as listed in the Economic Recovery Act, and delegated authority to authority staff, chief executive officer, and the chief community development officer to authorize the program start date pending completion of phase two. This is the implementation funding for the technical planning gaps in the projects identified in phase one. The authority will provide catalytic gap funding to GRMs to meet the technical planning needs for the projects identified in that phase. The applicants will be limited to the GRM municipalities themselves and will be tasked with the project selection from actionable products listed in the strategic action plan. They will also be the applicants and grantees, should the board decide, will be tasked with the contracting and oversight of the technical planning funding as well. In total, this is $2,250,000, of which up to $750,000 will be available to each GRM. Each project, as listed by the government restricted municipality, will be limited to $250,000 per project. This program will not cover any hard costs. In background, the awards will be made to the government district and municipalities for projects proposed in the strategic action plan and funded based on municipally authored project prioritization plan. The project prioritization plan will detail the municipality's projects and the technical planning gaps in those projects. Each of these will be selected by the GRM in a competitive fashion based on the municipal goals. This prioritization plan will look at the phase one projects and will go through a competitive municipal evaluation. The prioritization plan must include the projects from the previous phase one strategic action plan. The municipality will then prioritize those projects in funding order. The most important project to the municipality will be funded as will be number one and then list down in descending order. The projects included in the plan must be originated from the strategic action plan. Those projects included must be evaluated by municipal competition, which will be based on criteria relevant to the municipal goals for equitable community-focused economic development. And again, the municipality will select the number, type, scope, and priority of the projects to be included in the phase two. The phase two opening will be decided by delegated staff authority on a date on or after the deadline for the phase one closed by the authority. The scope of work. Applicants are to complete strategic action plans as developed in phase one. These applications must be focused on the technical planning gaps listed in the strategic plans and then prioritized. The technical planning funding is designed to bridge gaps in business case study analysis, financial analysis, community engagement, engineering, architectural, scientific, and planning, and media planning and analysis. No awards will be made for hard costs, no awards for property acquisition, no funding will be awarded for the administration or supervision of the grant and projects. Applicants must submit a prioritized project list with technical assistance gaps identified, and all applications must meet or exceed the minimum score of 50 out of 100 to be eligible for award. This project, the applicants can hire and subcontract with outside experts, firms, and other entities, and may use a combination of approaches to achieve the program goal, completing technical planning on projects as described in the plan. The eligible applicants are defined as the GRMs themselves, who have completed a plan developed under Phase 1. All applicant proposals must be focused on the technical planning needs for the projects, and a municipality may only submit one application. The application must consist of a prioritized project listing, as defined before, which will be projects included from the completed Phase 1 strategic action plan and selected by the municipality in a competitive format. The technical planning gaps must be identified, and then the projects must be listed in priority order by the municipality. Additionally, they must define their ability to contract for technical planning professional services, define a stakeholder engagement process, and then give examples of the prior experience. Project funding will be based on the prioritization as set forward by the municipality themselves. Each of the three GRMs will be eligible for up to $750,000 for the completion of technical planning, and any one project is capped at $250,000. Each disbursement must be accompanied by a project report, and disbursements will only be made after the submission and approval by the authority of project reports. To summarize, we request the board for the creation of the Government Restricted Municipality Planning Grant Program, Phase 2, authorize $2,250,000 from the Economic Recovery Act of 2020 for funding, and delegated authority to authority staff to authorize the program start date pending the completion of Phase 1. Thank you very much.
All righty. Any questions for John on Phase 2? If there's no questions for John, can I get a motion to approve?
It's Rosemary. I'm sorry. I was going to let someone go before me. Just a quick question. Am I understanding Phase 1 is strategic? Is the strategic plan? And then Phase 2 is the actual technical planning and professional services. Is that the difference between the two phases?
The strategic action plan identifies the projects and the technical planning gaps, and Phase 2 is the implementation funding for them.
The implementation of the project? Because I thought this was just the technical planning implementation would be a Phase 3.
It's the implementation. It's the implementation funding for the technical planning gaps for the projects.
I'm not sure I understood that. Can you say that differently for me?
If I can, this is Kai. So one of the things that we've acknowledged with municipalities is that they often put plans together, but they don't have the funds or the resources to implement them. So what we're doing through this three-pronged approach is making sure that there is a plan that they're putting in place in the first iteration of this program. And then the second one is what they're going to actually implement. So this is the implementation dollars. So it doesn't just become like a nice plan on a bookshelf that never gets used, but one that's actually going to be implemented. So that's the two distinctions between the two plans. One, because you're going to need resources to actually put together a study, do the research.
Right.
And the second is to actually implement that plan into you.
So Phase 2 is implementation of what they actually put in the plan itself. Is that correct, Todd?
Exactly.
Okay. So there's no Phase 3 coming on that because it should be taken care of in 1 and 2?
That's the assumption in how we've written the plan out.
Okay. And then the last question said something about, is the cap $250K for Plan 2 or for the total of 1 and 2 cumulative?
Ms. Hicks, that is a $250,000 per project cap in Phase 2. So no one project set by a municipality can go over $250,000.
Great. Thanks so much. Answers my questions.
Chair, Fred Dumas.
Please, Fred.
So in my new life here, I'm running a municipality. Good ideas and a good the good objects we want to do on a daily basis are always stopped because of budget limitations. So this gives us in municipalities another tool to get out in front and really do the good work that our citizens need in these difficult times. So I support the program 100%.
Thank you, Fred.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Fred. Any other questions for John? All right. Can I get a motion to approve?
It's Fred. I'll make the motion.
Thank you, Fred. Can I get a second?
Jenny Bauer, I'll second.
Thank you, Jenny. Any more discussion? If there's no more discussion, all in favor, aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, next item on the agenda, the Economic Growth Port Infrastructure. Request for modified approval of the authority's letter of intent with PSE&G in order to continue early site works beyond June 30, 2021. Jonathan Kennedy, Managing Director, Infrastructure Economic Growth, presenting. Jonathan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members are asked to approve the continuation of early works for the New Jersey Wind Port project beyond June 30, 2021. In April of this year, the board approved an amendment to the authority's existing letter of intent with PSEG to include certain early site works and to extend the LOI cooperation period to December 31 of this year. These are critical path early site works. They include, for instance, permitting activities, environmental testing, some limited site preparation, works necessary to preserve the target of commencing core construction in late 2021. At the time of the April board approval, in order to manage the authority's cost exposure prior to securing property rights, staff committed to report back to the board on progress towards a ground lease and to seek approval to continue early works if a lease was not in place by June 30, 2021. Staff are pleased to report that negotiations have progressed materially since April, with a draft lease, draft ground lease, that is, currently undergoing final review by both parties. We anticipate lodging said lease with the Office of State Comptroller in the next week or so. So allowing for kind of OSC review, we anticipate bringing the ground lease to the in July. In context, staff are seeking board approval to continue early site works beyond June 30, 2021. In order to present the development schedule for the port. Happy to take any questions.
All right, questions. If somebody could go on mute, we have a family feud going on. Any questions for Jonathan? Any questions for Jonathan? If there's no questions, can I get a motion to approve?
Robert Chimko, approve.
Thank you, Robert. Can I get a second?
Phil Rogers, second.
Thank you, Phil. Any discussion? If there's no discussion. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, it's Kathy. Is there a way for staff to figure out whose line needs to be muted?
Yeah, the operator should be able to do that.
Yeah, we're actively trying to determine the line. Apologies.
All righty. Okay, let's try to do our best. If there's no discussion, all in favor, aye.
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 You will?
Yeah.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions?
Elizabeth, right, Dragon, you have abstaining from this because the department currently has reviews pending for review.
All right, Elizabeth, thank you for that. Now let's move on to the incentives section of the agenda. Jenny Bauer, Chair, will introduce this section and turn it back over to me. Jenny.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Incentive Committee met on May 27th, and as always, there were a number of important issues discussed, namely the offshore wind economic development tax credit, as well as a number of film and digital media tax credits. So we will look forward to getting those approvals. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jenny. First item. In incentives is offshore wind an approval of amendments to existing offshore wind economic development tax credit rules. Pallavi Madhukasira, Director, Clean Energy Sector Lead, Economic Growth. Pallavi.
Thank you. Members of the board are requested to approve amendments to the existing offshore wind economic development tax credit rules and to authorize staff to file the amended rules. I want to take a couple of minutes to provide some background. The offshore wind economic development tax credit is one of the 15-plus programs that is part of the Economic Recovery Act package. The current offshore wind economic development tax credit program provides tax credits for capital investment in a qualified wind energy facility located in New Jersey. The program is designed to spur employment growth and offshore wind supply chain development as a result of capital investment in land-based offshore wind industry projects. In order to receive tax credit through the program, a business must meet three main criteria. The first, make or acquire capital investments totaling at least $50 million in a qualified wind energy facility. But if the business is a tenant, the business must lease an area of the qualified wind energy facility that represents at least $17.5 million capital investment in the facility. The second is the business needs to create the required minimum number of full-time jobs over the four-year commitment period. And third, demonstrate a net positive economic benefit to the state. The authority is proposing amendments to the Offshore Wind Economic Development Tax Credit Program to implement certain statutory revisions. There are three primary revisions enacted by the law, and I will go over them one by one. The first is adjusting the period over which the tax credits are earned and paid out. The program previously awarded tax credits over the course of 10 years. The new statute states that the award of the tax credit shall be structured so that the award shall be comprised of 4 years, each equaling 25% of the total value of the tax credit. The statute also states that the amount of the tax credit shall be taken over a five-year period at the rate of one-fifth of the total amount of the business's credit for each tax accounting or privilege period of the business. Accordingly, the amendments to the rules now define the four-year period as the commitment period and the corresponding award amounts serve as the mechanism by which the award is earned. And the five-year period is defined as the eligibility period, and the corresponding one-fifth award amounts serve as the mechanism by which the tax credit is taken. The second change enacted by the law is adjusting the minimum number of jobs required for the program. There are two components to this. The first, allowing for a project to ramp up jobs over time. The statute and rules previously required that a project create all new full-time jobs before a project could be awarded tax credits. The new statutory language creates a ramp-up mechanism that allows the business to start earning and being paid tax credits as long as they meet certain minimum number of jobs over the first 4 years of their project. And the minimum number of employee threshold that a business needs to meet in the first, second, third, and the fourth year is 100, 150, 200, and 300 new full-time employees, respectively, for each of those 4 years, compared to the number of full-time employees at the time of application. We think that the ramp-up period is appropriate for a brand-new industry that is starting from scratch, not just in New Jersey, but just across the United States. The second portion to this change is allowing for the authority to create a prorated formula to award credits to projects that create between 100 and 300 new full-time jobs. The statute previously required a minimum threshold of 300 new full-time employees at a qualified wind energy facility to be eligible for the program. The statute now allows for projects with less than 300 but more than 150 full-time employees to be eligible, but then would receive a prorated award. The amount of the award, therefore, as determined by the authority, will be equal to a percentage of a capital investment. So for projects with 150 employees, the award is calculated at 50% of the capital investment. For those with 200, the award is 65%. And for projects with 250, it is 85% of the capital investment. The third primary change enacted by the law is expanding the eligible geography for the program from 7 counties to the entire state. The statute previously defined the eligible geographies only as the southern seven counties in the state. The new statutory language expands the definition to include all counties in the state. We certainly expect that the southern part of our state will continue to be a core focus for the offshore wind industry. However, we also think that this change is consistent in that there is an opportunity for investment across several different regions, specifically opportunities in Atlantic County and opportunities around the New York Harbor that the state wants to be able to have tools to support. In addition to providing clarity on how to address the above statutory changes, the proposed amendments also include policy updates on eligible costs, calculating net benefits test parameters and fees, and those are detailed in the attached appendix to the memo. Thank you.
Great. Do we have any questions for Pallavi? There's no questions for Pallavi. Can I get a motion to approve?
Jenny Elizabeth Dragon.
Thank you. Thank you, Jenny. Can I get a second?
Marlene Caridi, second.
Thank you, Marlene. Any discussion? There's no discussion. All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, the next item on the agenda is the Film and Digital Media Tax Credit. I won't go through all the names of all five TV and film credits. I'll let David in his will provide a single presentation to cover these, and then we'll have five individual votes. David Lawyer, Managing Director, Underwriting, presenting. David.
Thank you. EDA staff has completed the review and recommends approval of five applications under the Film Tax Credit Program. We have received written confirmation from an outside firm hired to review the production budgets that they are reasonable by industry standards. All of the film content has also been reviewed and recommended for approval under the Act by the New Jersey Motion Picture and Television Commission. Total credits utilized across the five recommended approvals is $23 million. The first application is Survivalist the Film, Inc., who produced The Survivalist. We are recommending an award of $642,824, which includes a location bonus of $11,216. The second application is Universal Television, LLC, who produced Lincoln. We are recommending an award of $12,911,280, which includes a diversity bonus of $806,330 and a location bonus of $10,000. The third application is Universal Content Productions, LLC, who produced Masters of Doom pilot. We are recommending an award of $3,205,416. The fourth application is Apple Slice Productions, LLC, who will produce Jules. We are recommending an award of $3,742,405. And finally, the fifth application is Redo Askew LLC, who will produce Clerks 3. We are recommending an award of $2,532,789, which includes a diversity bonus of $158,299. Each project needs its own separate vote. Back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, David. David, just an observation. You ought to get into the voiceover business as a side gig.
I'll take
all
that
right.
Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the staff, David does not have any spare time for such things. He's one of the busiest people in show business, but I don't disagree with the sentiment.
All right. Let's move to a vote on the first item, which is Survivalist the Film. A tax credit of $642,824.50. Can I get a motion to approve?
So moved, Wilton.
Thank you, Brian. Can I get a second?
Second, Elijah.
Thank you, Phil. Any discussion? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. Next item is Universal Television, LLC, a tax credit of almost $13 million, producing Lincoln. Can I get a motion to approve?
So moved.
Jenny Bauer, I'll move it.
Marlene Caridi, second.
Second. Marlene, thank you. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, next item, Universal Content Productions, LLC, a tax credit of just over $3.2 million, producing the Masters of Doom pilot. Can I get a motion to approve?
Marlene Caridi approves. Moves.
Thank you, Marlene. Can I get a second?
Second,
Elijah. Second.
Thank you, Phil. Any discussion? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, next item is Apple Slice Productions, LLC, a tax credit of just over $3.7 million, producing Jewels. Can I get a motion to approve?
Moved, Angela.
Marlene Creed, seconds.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Marlene. Any discussion? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, our last item under Film and Digital Media Tax Credit, Redo Askew, LLC, a tax credit of just over $2.5 million, producing Clerks 3. Can I get a motion to approve?
Jenny Bauer, I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Can I get a second?
Hello.
I'm sorry, who was that, the second?
Rob Angelo.
Thank you, Rob. Any discussion? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, we're going to move to the next section of our agenda. Marcia Marley, the chair of our Director's Loan Review Committee, will make some comments and then turn it back over to me. Marcia.
Thank you, Chairman. The Director's Loan Review Committee met on May 27th. The committee evaluated and discussed a bond to the not-for-profit Chatham Day School for $9 million and several requests for changes in the Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation HDSRF program. HDSRF requests included rule amendments to conform with amended legislation and an increase in delegated authority for grant requests and for new delegated authority for bonds. Approvals for additional delegated authority levels are requested in order to increase efficiency, minimize delays, and bring HDSRF more in line with other EDA program levels. I want to thank the staff for their presentation to the committee for these proposals that are now being presented to the full board for consideration. Chairman, I turn it back over to you.
Great. Thank you, Marcia. The first item on the agenda is a combination preliminary and final bond resolution for the Chatham Day School. David Lawyer, Managing Director, Underwriting, presenting. David.
Thank you. Chatham Day School, Inc., established in 1988, is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization established for the purpose of providing an independent school education for students in preschool through the eighth grade. The school serves a population of 240 students. The authority has prior experience with its applicant as we closed on a $5 million tax-exempt bond in May 2005, which has been paid in full. Requested is a $9 million direct purchase tax-exempt bond from which Provident Bank is the lender. And as the chairman mentioned, this is both a preliminary and final bond resolution. The bond will have a term of 10 years, 25-year amortization, and an indicative tax-exempt interest rate of 2.96%. Authority assistance will enable the applicant to reduce its interest expense by refinancing an existing mortgage on the commercial property. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, David. Do we have any questions for David? There's no questions for David. Can I get a motion to approve?
Motion to approve, Marcia.
Thank you, Marcia. Can I get a second?
It's Jenny Bauer. I'll second.
Thank you, Jenny. Any discussion? There's no discussion. All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, let's move to loans, grants, and guarantees, the Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Fund. First item is the Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Rule Amendments and Delegated Authority, Elizabeth Limbrick, Director, Brownfield and Sustainable Systems, presenting. Elizabeth.
Thank you, Chairman. I'm very pleased to be here to present this to you. This memo contains three items related to the Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Fund, or HDSRF, as we affectionately call it here. In this memo, we're requesting that the board approve rule amendments to conform with the amended HDSRF legislation, and then also two changes to delegated authority. One, to increase the delegated authority threshold from $100,000 to $500,000 for staff to approve grant applications under the HDSRF program. And the other would be a new delegated authority for staff to approve loan applications up to $500,000 under the HDSRF program. Just a little background on this program. This program is jointly administered through a partnership with the Department of Environmental Protection as well as the authority. The DEP first evaluates an applicant's preliminary eligibility requirements and their estimated remediation costs. Upon DEP's recommendation for funding, it's then transmitted to EDA, and EDA evaluates the applicant's financial status, determines grant or loan eligibility, and then awards the funding. The financial assistance provided by this program is particularly important in the redevelopment of older urban areas and New Jersey's most distressed communities, and this is really vital to achieving a stronger, fairer, greener, and more equitable New Jersey. I would also just add that this program is in the New Jersey Constitution, and there is a portion of the corporate business tax that is used to fund this program. So the first thing we have in here are the statutory amendments and regulatory amendments. So the statutory revisions were enacted in 2018 to the HDSRF program, and those statutory revisions require the authority to update its regulations to reflect those changes. And specifically, these amendments require EDA to develop criteria to demonstrate commitment for public entities, incorporate readiness to proceed with remediation as a criterion of prioritization of grants, requires us to update sections to reflect reduced loan and grant amount, elimination of grants to innocent parties, and timeframes for completion of the preliminary assessment, site investigation, and remedial investigation. Update rules, it also requires us to update our rules to reflect the statutory changes that enact timeframes for the completion of certain remediation tasks for which the funds were awarded, and if those certain milestones are not met, the authority may cancel the award. It requires us requires that public entities demonstrate that previous awards have been or will be fully expended before the authority will render new financial assistance, and it changes the priority of funding awarded from the HDSRF. Now, of particular note for the board, I wanted to point out that in consultation with DEP, we drafted the amendments for the specific criteria to demonstrate the commitment to develop or redevelop the property and the readiness to proceed with remediation. The rules lay out the ways in which a public entity can demonstrate their commitment to develop or redevelop the property, and specifically this includes but is not limited to, one, a resolution to complete an investigation to determine whether an area which includes the real property, is an area that is in need of redevelopment or an area in need of rehabilitation. Alternatively, if they've already done that, they can demonstrate that the property is, in fact, within an area designated as an area in need of redevelopment or rehabilitation, and that the proposed project is consistent with that designation. Another way they can show their commitment is to demonstrate that the project plan is consistent with a community-driven vision or need to address environmental or public health issues as formalized in a plan by a community-based organization, so something like a neighborhood plan. The commitment can be demonstrated by providing a resolution by the local governing body that demonstrates their financial commitment for a development or redevelopment project. And they may also approve this by demonstrating they have a commitment to leverage other stable financial funding sources, including federal or state funding, that may expire, and that would ensure the project viability. So under these rules, at a minimum, an applicant must demonstrate their readiness to proceed with remediation by securing site control and retaining a licensed site remediation professional, also known as an LSRP. The applicant may further demonstrate their readiness through local support for the remediation activities, including but not limited to a resolution by the local governing body in support or financial commitment for the investigation or the remediation activities. And additional factors may be considered that include, but are not limited to, and I'm going to list these in the order of priority. One, projects that have a commitment of stable leverage funding sources and require financial assistance or a grant from the fund to fulfill a cost share requirement. And one example I could give you is if a municipality had a grant from the United States Environmental Protection Agency, and that grant said, you know, you need to have a cost share of 20%, and they needed to perform that within a certain time or the grant would expire. We would want to be able to prioritize a project like that so that we could get the HDSRF funds to them before that other grant expired so that they could really leverage those other funds. Projects, the other next one is projects located in a community collaborative initiative municipality, and this really ties in closely with our MOU with NJDEP, and these cities are among New Jersey's most distressed municipalities. Third, projects that have a resolution from the local governing body demonstrating a financial commitment for the development or redevelopment of the project. And then fourth, projects with stakeholder and community engagement, which further supports environmental justice. The proposed amended rules are included as an attachment to this memorandum. These amendments were developed in consultation with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, and in particular with the Brownfields and Site Remediation Program staff, and have received approval by DEP's Chief Advisor for Regulatory and Legislative Affairs. We have sought input from stakeholders through a variety of methods. We have posted the draft rules on our website back in March. We provided a dedicated email address to collect comments, and as well, the Licensed Site Remediation Professional Association, the LSRPA, published
information. I could tell him he's not feeling well.
I'm sorry, we're getting a little background noise.
Sorry,
continue. Okay. The LSRPA had published information about the statutory changes in their April 6, 2018 newsletter, and the Brownfield Coalition of the Northeast, or BCONE, had published information regarding the statutory changes and solicited stakeholder input in their July 16, 2018 newsletter. In addition to that, the proposed rules were also presented at the March 9th, 2021 NJDEP Quarterly Brownfields Roundtable. There were representatives from the regulated community, state agency representatives, federal government representatives, local government, and academia. Participants were also provided with a copy of the draft regulations, and no substantive comments have been received. We do believe that there's a lot of support for this. What I will tell you is, in addition, yesterday, NJDEP held their next quarterly Brownfields Roundtable, and at that, they did encourage folks to attend today's board meeting and, let them know that we do have that public comment period at the end as well. So I'm not sure if we'll hear from anybody, but I know folks are very much aware of this, and there's a lot of support for these changes. The next one is about delegated authority. So EDA staff seeks to have its delegated authority threshold increased from $100,000 to $500,000 regarding the approval of HDSRF grant applications, and establish, again, new delegated authority to approve loan requests up to $500,000. And the main purpose of these requests really is to minimize delays in the processing and funding of applications that are in the HDSRF program queue. These delegations are consistent with and in some cases actually much lower than the delegated authority provided for other EDA programs. A typical HDSRF grant would fall within that $500,000 range when including supplemental applications. And these projects are routinely supported by NJEDA and NJDEP. Just an important point I wanted to note here, that this delegated authority includes both new and supplemental applications. What we find is once the municipalities start doing remediation, they start digging, often they find additional remediation required, and that scope of the project increases. By granting this delegated authority, this would allow us to, you know, just more efficiently and quickly be able to process all HDSRF applications for a larger volume of projects, which would really streamline and advance the redevelopment of projects more efficiently in the state. Initial and supplemental grant applications and loan applications that exceed that $500,000 would be presented to the board for approval. This approach is consistent with other recently approved EDA programs where similar delegated authority was granted for the same purposes. So we really are recommending the board approve the proposed rule amendments and authorize staff to submit the proposed rule amendments for promulgation in the New Jersey Register, subject to the final review and approval of the Office of Attorney General and the Office of Administrative Law. In addition, we're recommending the board increase the staff delegated authority to approve grant applications under the HDSRF program from $100,000 to $500,000, and again, provide EDA staff new delegated authority to approve applications up to $500,000 under the HDSRF program. As a note, I would just like the board to know that we are looking at other potential improvements to the program, which may require statutory changes. I understand that a bill was also just proposed in the assembly as well that would require additional statutory changes. So if that were to move forward, you may be seeing us again in the near future. So with that, I want to thank you and turn it back to the chairman.
Great. Thank you, Elizabeth. Do we have any questions for Elizabeth? If there's no questions for Elizabeth, can I get a motion to approve?
Motion to approve, Marcia.
Thank you, Marcia. Can I get a second?
Second, Elijah.
Thank you, Phil. Any discussion? There's no discussion. All in favor? Aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. The next item. And we'll just have one vote here, is on a summary of NJDEP Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Fund Program projects approved by the Departmental of Environmental Protection. David Lawyer, Managing Director, Underwriting, presenting. David.
Thank you. Under DEP's Hazardous Discharge Site Remediation Program, we have three approval requests totaling $1.56 million. These requests require board approval, as each requested amount exceeds our $100,000 staff delegation. The first is the Camden Redevelopment Agency in the amount of $103,825. The proceeds will be used to fund costs associated with remedial investigation at a former manufacturing facility which has potential areas of concern. It is the applicant's intent upon full site remediation to redevelop the site for residential and recreational use. The second request is also from the Camden Redevelopment Agency in the amount of $1,136,612. Proceeds will be used to fund costs associated with remedial action at the same site, which again is a former manufacturing facility and having potential environmental areas of concern that will be redeveloped for residential and recreational use. The third and last request is the Borough of Pennington in the amount of $312,041. This is a supplemental request to fund costs associated with remedial investigation at a former landfill. At the EDA's May 2019 board, the members approved an initial grant in the amount of $301,604, also for remedial investigation activities. It is the applicant's intent upon full site remediation to redevelop the site for recreational use. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, David. Do we have any questions for David? We have no questions for David. Can I get a motion to approve?
Bradford just got back to me.
What did she say?
At 11 with
Elizabeth.
Can I get a motion?
Jenny Battle.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you, Jenny. Any discussion? All in favor, aye.
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 Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right. Our last item for voting this morning, petroleum underground storage tank. This is the Remediation Upgrade and Closure Fund Program projects approved by the Department of Environmental Protection. David, if you could take us through this.
Yes. Under DEP's Petroleum UST Remediation Program, we have two approval requests totaling $162,110. The first application is from Susie Hobbs in the amount of $11,419. This is a supplemental application as the applicant previously received total grants of $106,537 for the same residence. The proceeds will be used to remove a leaking underground storage tank and complete the required remediation at the applicant's primary residence. Board approval is required as the aggregate supplemental funding, including this request, exceeds our $100,000 delegation. The second application is from Norrie's Auto Repair, a commercial property owned by Forad Norrie. The amount of this request is $150,690. This is a supplemental application as the applicant previously received total grants of $662,420 for the same property. The proceeds will be used to remove a leaking underground storage tank and complete the required groundwater remediation. Board approval is required as the request exceeds our $100,000 delegation. Back to you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, David. Any questions for David? No questions. Can I get a motion to approve?
Motion to approve, Elizabeth Dragon.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Can I get a second?
Jenny Bauer, I'll second.
Thank you, Jenny. Any discussion? There's no discussion. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any recusals, abstentions? All right, let's move to board memoranda. Tim Sullivan, CEO, presenting. Tim.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. You've got a memo in your pack for credit underwriting. I would just want to highlight the 27 microbusiness loan programs that were approved this most recent period. These are important. This isn't a COVID-specific program per se, but given what's going on in the world, obviously every small business and every microbusiness is impacted by COVID. This has been a lifeline. These have been lifelines for lots of small businesses throughout the state. So we will continue to see approvals in this program as we ramp it up, and we're excited about the progress that we're making there. With that, happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Tim? No questions. Let's move to the open public comment. Public comment portion of the meeting. I'd like to ask Danielle Esser to read the NJEDA's public comment policy and process for this telephonic board meeting, as well as the availability of COVID-19 resources for businesses seeking information. Danielle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As stated by the operator at the beginning of the meeting, members of the public interested in providing public comment can press 1, then 0 on their phone to be registered to speak, which will place each person into a queue based on the order received. Given the number of members of the public on the call this morning, we'd like to go over NJEDA's public comment policy at this time, which is also available on the NJEDA website. Each speaker will be prompted by the operator to speak one at a time. Each speaker should announce his or her name, organization affiliation, and the topic on which the remarks will be given. Each speaker will have a maximum of 3 minutes to speak and should limit comments to matters pertaining to the authority. Staff will prompt the speaker once their time has expired. The speaker may not register to speak more than once during the same public comment period to ensure enough time is available for all of those who wish to speak. And as always, speakers may provide comments in writing to email for staff. For members of the public seeking information on COVID-19 resources for businesses, we direct you to cv.business.nj.gov, which is staffed by business advocates at the New Jersey Business Action Center. The site includes a chat feature staffed to answer your business-related questions to COVID-19. You can also call the state's hotline COVID-19 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday at 1-800-JERSEY-7 or 1-800-537-7397. This portal can also be accessed directly from the NJEDA main page, njeda.com. We look forward to receiving your public comments at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press 1, then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, you may press 1, then 0 at this time. One moment for our first question. We have no questions in queue. Please continue.
Thank you, operator. If there are no comments, questions, I'd like to thank everyone for their participation in the meeting this morning. I will make a motion to adjourn the meeting. Can I get a second?
Second, Fred Dumont.
Thank you, Fred. All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All righty, everyone. Thank you. Enjoy your week, your weekend. Till next month. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, and that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T conferencing service. You may now disconnect.
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.